Before we continue, one of the ways we keep all of our content for you, the listener, free of charge is our amazing sponsors, and today, Anchor is one of those sponsors. If you haven't heard about Anchor, it's the easiest way to make a podcast. Let me explain. It's free, there's creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcasts right from your phone or computer. Anchor is going to distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere podcasts are listened to, and you can even make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Marvel Movie News.
Good morning, Barry Marvelites. Christian Bott here for another fun installment of Marvel Movie News, joined by Rachel Radner, Rachel Goodman, and of course, Michael Shirley. And if you're a Marvel fan to the extent that you watch a show like this, our guest needs no introduction, but he deserves one. So I'll let you know that we're joined by author Chris Claremont, who is responsible for the legendary 17-year run on Uncanny X-Men and a variety of adjacent ongoing X-Men titles and miniseries. Essentially, the story for every Marvel movie in the majority of the animated series was inspired by stories Chris wrote. And in any case, Chris, welcome back to the show. I'm Christian. That's Rachel. That's Michael. We're very happy that you are joining us today.
Oh, it's very cool, man. I'm totally like, you know, just I'm cool.
I had to have my. I like your shades.
Yeah. Hey, 30-second really shitty impersonation. Oh, nice laugh. My teeny tiny eyes.
Well, just
trying to channel Stan.
Yeah, exactly. I want to jump right into what we're specifically talking to you about today, which is this new extended cut of God Loves, Man Kills that I think a lot of people would say is the seminal X-Men story, originally published in 1982. There's now this extended cut that literally came out this week. And I kind of want to talk about the original approach to God Loves, Man Kills that, and you talk about it in an interview that's in this extended cut, that the idea was this was a standalone X-Men story that if you never read any other X-Men story, you would get it from this story.
Yep. Absolutely.
So obviously it being a graphic novel, it's, you know, aimed at more mature audiences, and it's a little bit more adult, you know, not that the, you know, not that I'm saying the comic books are for kids, but there's some moments in there that I think are very much able to be a little bit more graphic. Like for me, whenever I think of the story, there's that, you know, horrific scene in the first couple of pages, at least in the original version, where the purifiers kill the brother and sister and hang them up on the swing set. This is always the first thing I think about. And I think that you're able to have that, you know, when Kitty's speaking with Stevie Hunter, she uses the N-word, which today we refer to that just as the N-word. And I think it's such an important moment. And I'm glad that when this is being re-released for a modern day audience, they didn't feel compelled to make any changes. Were there conversations about should any of this change, or was it always we're going to present it as is?
There were no conversations. I mean, the thing to bear in mind is that when this was originally published, mainstream monthly, bi-monthly comics were under the auspices of the Comics Code Authority. There were no inappropriate words whatsoever. I mean, we couldn't even call people zombies. That's where the Marvel term Zubembies came from, because it was considered too creepy. So, well, it was a more innocent age.
Sure.
You know, I mean, that was back in the era when if a president did something wrong, we booted him out of office. And if he hadn't been pardoned, he would have been indicted. So obviously,
I don't even know if I can remember a time like that. But yeah, to your point about the comics code, I know that, you know, famously there were issues of Amazing Spider-Man where Harry Osborn is addicted to drugs, and the whole point is drugs are bad, kids. And the comics code was like, no, we can't teach them lessons about drugs being bad. So right. I think that well, that was kind of the first instance, at least, where Stan was like, well, we got to do these stories anyway.
That was Stan's instance, but at the same time, Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams did this. I think it was Neil Adams, but Denny O'Neill wrote an equally powerful story involving
Speedy, I believe. I believe it's Speedy.
Well, it was what's it? Green Arrow and his kid sidekick.
Yeah. Arsenal, Speedy.
Yeah, so I think Speedy. He went by Speedy at
Speedy
the time.
Back
yeah.
then. So I would have thought that was the name that would go to Flash's kid, but there you go.
Of course.
DC was much more onomatopoeic. But the point was that in that era, in that time, in that place, there was a need to, for want of a better phrase, get more relevant. And that meant addressing concepts and attitudes. I mean, in the moment where Green Lantern is confronted by this elderly black gentleman who says, you do a lot for the green folks, you do a lot for the purple folks, you do a lot for the red folks, when are you going to do something for the black folks? And I remember reading it when I was in high school and thinking, holy cow. Because you had Neil's extraordinary visuals, I mean, powerfully empathetic visuals, and you had Denny's script. And it was like, wow. You don't see things like that in a comic book. And those were the first, I guess, shots across the bow of the Comics Code to say, we're trying to grow up a little. And we want to talk about things that are not just, oh, Superman, I'm going to turn into a black person for a day so I can see what it's like. I mean, one would think if Superman and Lois were going to do a story like that, the machine would break and she'd be stuck that way and they would both have to deal with it. And how would it be if she walked back into the Daily Planet and Perry wouldn't hire her because she is a person of color?
Oh, you've got a story right there.
Yeah.
40 years out of date.
Well, still, go ahead, Rachel.
My question is then, given the time period of when this was first originally published, how mm-hmm. did they get around any pushback that might have been given toward the comic for bringing up this topic?
Well, that was why it was done as a graphic novel. The epic line was meant to be stuff we couldn't do in the traditional Marvel format. It was supposed to be quote unquote adult material. It'd be like saying, we're going to do an episode of Magnum PI, but we're going to do it in the movies. Why? Well, because we can do stuff in the movies that we can't do on TV. And, you know, it's, for us, a lot of the temptation is, well, we'll just throw in a lot of naughty language. And, or, you know, lots of TNA, because that was where everyone's mind goes in that first instance. And Wheezy Simonson and Brett and I, we didn't want to go down that road. We wanted to do a story as, you know, as we said a few minutes ago, if you only read one X-Men story and you want to know what the whole Michigas is all about, mutants, normal people, heroes, villains, this would be it. And that's why the adversary definitely is someone we couldn't do in a regular issue because, you know, we were coming right out and saying, this is a major league televangelist, evangelical Christian who doesn't have a clue what it really means. He is a soldier, a ranger who, with the death of his wife and kids, has lost his way. He thought he found it by becoming a minister, by embracing what his perception of the word of God. But coming from the reality of being a soldier, of being a person of conflict, he drew the wrong lessons. He viewed this as a war, a battle between good and evil, between Christianity and everybody else. And he defined his actions on those terms. It's not to say that belief is bad or that religion is bad, but you can get off the track from the best of intentions as easily as you can from the worst of intentions. And the key to this, for me anyway, is the person who finds the kids, the person who has the initial reaction to what's happening, who looks at it and says, this is 1940 all over again, is Magneto. This is the world he endured as a child and will do anything to prevent it. And what I was trying to say, what we Brett and I were trying to say in this story is, yes, Magneto is the adversary, but he's not the bad guy. And it comes down to, at the end, him saying, see, Charles, I was right.
I know.
No, go ahead.
I know initially when the idea for this story came up, they wanted Magneto to die in the very beginning. If you had to stick with that, how would that story have even worked?
I would have found a way, but no, having Magneto, I mean, if you look at the Neil Adams, when Neil did 5 or 6 pages to demonstrate his approach to the story, it's a wonderful superhero moment. It's a battle between the X-Men and Magneto, buildings fall on everybody. I look at that and I think, oh, okay, Spielberg, go to town. But it wouldn't have been the story that Brent and I told. It wouldn't have gone the direction that we wanted to, we and Wheezy wanted to go in. And I don't know if it were as powerful, it would be for totally different reasons. This is not a story about superheroes. It's a story about people. It's a story about the 8 of them coming face to face with what it means to be an X-Men, why they're walking down the path they're going, and why a lot of the perspective bounces between Kitty and Ilyana. The kids are the defining moment here. The adults, they run into trouble, but the kids are the ones who end up saving the day or trying to save the day. And it focuses in on Kitty with Stryker saying about Nightcrawler, you dare call that human? And Kitty saying, yeah, if the choice is you or him, I'm going with him. Why? Because she knows that Kurt, for all his physiognomy, is probably the most devout Christian they know. Because Kurt's decision when he was young is, I can either hate myself or I can figure out that if I look this way, it's because God made a decision. If I say that God made a decision to make me a monster, does that make God evil? And if God's evil, what the hell is the point of my life? So he decided, finally, God did it for a reason. Therefore, being ethical and human, I've got to find the reason and live as much of my life as humanly possible by the tenets laid down in the New Testament. Because I went back and read the whole flipping book and, you know, and listened to evangelical preachers for like 6 months, all on TV, of course. And to me, it was a defining moment for him as a character. But then you have Kitty saying, yeah, if it's him or you, I'm with him. And that's why the saving total contrast to today in terms of perception, the person who saves the day, who resolves the conflict, is an officer of the law, because that's what good cops do. They resolve things positively.
So and that's one of the things that just in general that I really loved about the story is the way that you represented how things can be twisted, how there can be extremes with people who use propaganda and use religion as a means to an end. Like, for example, the way that Stryker was using Xavier to basically make everyone believe that he was inflicting the will of God near the end. And so my question to you is, during this writing process, when you're coming up with, when you're deciding to do all of these things, did you work with Brent Anderson like very closely ahead of time, or was it more of your vision and then he was able to kind of pull off of the vision that you had in the way that you wanted to represent this?
Well, I have to say the person who got involved, who I worked with most, was Wheezy. I mean, what a lot of people don't know, a lot of people don't understand about comics, especially in those days, the crucial role played by editors that could both damage a work and make it transcendent. I mean, when I came into the business, Stan was the boss. Stan was the editor in chief. Roy was his Roy Thomas was his right hand man. By the time this rolled around, the editor in chief was, I don't know if it was still Archie, but Archie was Epic. Jim Shooter was editor in chief.
Right, exactly.
But the managing boss of the X franchise was Louise Simonson. And what we basically do is I'd have an idea and then I would sit down and she and I would bat things back and forth. What do you think of this moment? What do you think of that moment? We'll go in this direction. We'll go, I don't know what to do next. Well, think about it a little and I'd have an inspiration. The thing I found most wonderful about her is her willingness to let me as a creator find my own answer and then run with it and see what happened next. She didn't feel impelled to impose a structure on things because then it would become, I guess, her story more than mine. But at the end result was, in a lot of ways, it was her story as much as mine. And then we'd both reach out to Brent and bring him into the creative matrix and see what ideas he had visually. The problem was, bluntly, in a normal world, we'd have had 6 months. And Brent's involvement would have been a whole lot more seminal and all embracing. But Marvel doesn't work that way, even then. So we were sitting there thinking, ha, we have our 6 months. And then two creators responsible for the issues ahead of us fell apart on deadlines. Which I know never happens these days. Everybody nails
it.
So this is why Bob McLeod and I suddenly discovered that what we thought would be the first issue of New Mutants was now a graphic novel, and we had to slam it out overnight, which we did. And then Brent and I were the next in line. So Brent was basically, I gotta draw this. Just send me the pages. So all the conceptual stuff fell on Wheezy's and my shoulders out of necessity.
Touching on,
because also we weren't working full script. Sorry, I'm getting tangled in my mic cord. The Marvel style that Stan established, time to do full scripts, and besides, when you're working with the like of Jack Kirby. Or Steve Ditko, why are you wasting your time? Just point Jack in the right direction and turn him loose, which if you want to know the bad side of that, read the first year of New Gods and just. He's so good.
Yes.
So he was so good, so creative, so gifted that every page of every issue was new stuff, which after three issues, as a reader, your head explodes because you can't keep track. And, well, DC has been living off of Jack's creation now for 35 years. But Stan knew how to edit him, which is to pare it down to the essentials that get you through that story and set up the next story. But to Jack, he's looking at all of his cool stuff being thrown away by Stan or postponed by Stan, and it made him crazy. The same thing sort of happened to me and John Byrne. John would draw this neat stuff and want the story to go in direction A, and I'd look at it and say, oh, no, B is so much better. And I'd just rewrite it.
Yeah.
And after 30 issues, it got to a point where John couldn't take it anymore. It would be like me writing a plot or writing a story and having the artist go somewhere completely different. And I'd have to figure out how to make it work, which happened to me a few years later.
Sure.
So with another artist who shall remain nameless. but that's it. Comics then was a totally interactive industry. Now, with writers essentially expected to write full scripts that are sent to whomever, sometimes it can work, but sometimes, as with the last few jobs that I've done for Marvel with Salvador La Roca, it's like, for my attitude is, why am I doing a full script? This is Salvi. He can anything, and the editors fortunately have agreed with me. So you find the right creative structure for each partner in turn, and you find a way to go with it.
In that same vein, the characters you've created, so many epic characters, and so many of them have gone through so many costume changes. So, you know, the first one's going to be like really important. When you're first creating a character, I'm sure it's different now than it was then, but how much did the writer or just you get to put into what the character's costume looked like and how they looked?
The irony is I just got copies of the omnibus, natural sized edition honoring Dave Cockrum. That's, I guess, is just coming out. And looking through that book, you will see exactly what I'm talking about in the sense with Dave. I mean, a lot of artists, if you ask them to design a character, will make a design and that's it. With Dave for Phoenix, for example, we talked about who she was, who we wanted Jean to be, what Phoenix could do, what did it mean? And then he went off and thought a little and came back and started sketching. And by the time he was done, we had 36, 40 designs. They weren't all unique designs. He had about a core of 7, but we would find different way, you know, is it a full body suit? Do we turn it into a bare waist? Do we turn it this color, that color? Boots that go to the thigh, boots that stay at her ankle, gloves that go round and round in circles, capes. We would play with it. He would play with it. And we look through and say, well, you know, if we took one from column A and put it on column B, okay, let's try this. Maybe not. Maybe we'll give her glasses. No, that didn't work either. You keep playing until you hit the right synergy. And then you think, oh, bingo. Then you have to find the color. So with Phoenix, it went around and around the circle. And again, some of these ideas were swiped for other characters. For example, in his case, Nightcrawler was originally intended for the Legion of Superheroes. So was Storm as a character named Black Cat. Looking at,
ooh,
color hardly changed from the original concept to what appeared in X-Men, Black Cat changed phenomenally when she became Storm. But that's what Dave does. He would play with concepts, play with characters, play with realities, and bingo. A talent like him is extraordinarily rare. B, it's not something that's done today simply because, I don't know, that's an editorial decision. I think part of the challenge is that no one outside of Spider-Man or maybe the FF, no one, or Superman or Batman, okay, maybe Wonder Woman, you don't think of characters with outfits that will last 7 or 8 decades. I mean, thinking of it, it won't be long before, well, you know, when Spider-Man was created a century ago.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, my screen just shut off.
Oh, well, we still see you.
Yeah. But
I mean, to think that we're talking, in Marvel, we're talking about characters who were created 70 years ago. Are these outfits relevant? Well, yeah, they work. Why? Because Iron Man's armor is cool. And yet in the movies, they found it a way to make it more cool with nanites.
Yeah.
Spider-Man, much for Bingo.
Yeah.
And you, in certain, how depending on how you, like Hawkeye, the visual evolves. So you find what works, and the same applies to comics. I think for me, if I were writing Magneto today, I would try to find a way to approach the purpose of the helmet. It shields me from telepaths. Okay, but you realize if someone hits you on the head with a hammer, that's got to hurt. Just from a echo alone. So is there anything else that helmet does? Well, I was thinking, okay, when he's in space, yes, the helmet links up, you know, there are membranes that automatically extend to the rest of his costume, and bingo, he's in a pressure suit. Over the years, my conception of, for example, the New Mutants or the classic X-Men armor, well, costume, well, it really looks kind of weird, just, you know, very 60s. Yeah, but what you don't realize, it's nanite body armor. It survives impacts from all manner of energy and projectile weapons. It'll protect you whether you're underwater, in vacuum space. You can survive whether you're in winter, Antarctic winter, or Saharan summer. Bingo! You can do anything with a skin-tight costume because, A, the character looks good, but B, you control the words. And the words are what are used to define the material, the costume, the person. So you play. You find, as things evolve, so does the storytelling or the way you structure the storytelling.
You know, in that vein, I think an interesting thing is, you know, Kitty, who is such an important character and always been my personal favorite, as I've talked to you about in the past. There were some very different growing pains and evolutions. So in this book, we have, of course, the Ariel costume and codename, which for me, she didn't actually have that long. I mean, it seemed like she settled into Shadowcat for a while. How much of that was behind the scenes, just trying to figure out what was right for her? Or did you think it was appropriate that a 13-year-old girl would probably just impulsively be like, no, I don't want to wear a skull cap. I want my hair to show. Or, you know, how much of that was just maybe you didn't like some of those designs for her earlier iterations? Because it seemed like she stuck with Shadowcat for the longest of at least those three before she went the Jean Grey route and really just became Kitty Pryde without a code name, as far as I can remember.
Mm-hmm. How to tactfully respond to this?
She looked kind of like Marvel Girl to me as
Ariel. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, one iteration.
Trying to show that before, yeah.
The thing to bear in mind, at least, again, we're talking a while ago.
Sure.
Is she was 13, which weirdly meant something significantly different than it has evolved to being now. For us doing the book, or for me writing the book, to be 13, whether it's her or Wolfsbane, or Bobby for that matter in New Mutants, it means someone's at the starting point of adolescence, which is where everything changes. She hasn't made up her mind. She doesn't know who she is. She hasn't a clue what's going on. All she wants to do is, oh my God, I'm in junior high, you know? And in Kitty's case, much as John really is pissed off at me, how do I differentiate her from everybody else in the team? She's the smart kid. Why? Because smart kids are loners, and smart kids feel oppressed by the world around them, i.e. everybody else. And smart girls are even more screwed up or screwed over than anybody else, because in those days, girls were just supposed to be ornaments. And having, you know, the only thing that would be worse is to be a black smart genius and be oppressed on every level. So, and she was from Chicago, which, you know, always has to get, has to deal with New York.
Yeah, of course.
Well, so, I know this because I have a chunk of family in Chicago and we would talk about this every now and then.
Yeah, they're literally referred to as the second city. They're telling you, you know, New York's better than you, right, Chicago?
Yeah. And Saturday Night Live has been living off of second city graduates for the last 40 years.
That's true.
That's very true.
You betcha.
So how did you get into...
How did I get into...
So how did you get into the mindset of a 13-year-old girl to be able to write her? Because, you know, reading this, I love how you represented this age period of a female.
Well, Wheezy's daughter, Juliana, was 13. Her best friends were a set of identical twins who were 13. I took notes. Because that's what writers do. It's like, there's a seminal moment from that, you know, Wheezy and Walter were away for a couple of weeks. They came home and Wheezy got a haircut. Her hair was really short and Walter had shaved. I don't know if you've seen any pictures of Walter. It's like, huh, gone the opposite route now. He's totally Letterman. But they walked in the door. They walked in the door of their apartment. Juliana took one look at them and ran away in tears, because the reality of her world had changed and no one had asked her. Well, I swiped that one.
Yeah.
Aurora comes back for, you know, shows up at Wolverine's wedding with a mohawk wearing skin-tied leather. And Kitty is like, oh my God. The reality of my world has just gone and, you know. The only worst thing would have been if she'd showed up with looking like that. With Yukio as her date.
Well, you know, referring to that, there's a question in the chat that kind of ties into this. It's from someone named Sam Edmonston. You know, in the present day and in more recent years, the idea of having gay characters is more acceptable, and characters that you write, I mean, you co-created North Star, and then obviously Bobby Drake was somebody that you you know, were able to write for a while. Were there ever any inklings that, even if it's not those characters, like I would point to, you know, Mystique and Destiny. I always felt like they had that sort of a relationship. Was there something that you were like, I feel this in my head, but Comics Code Authority editorial won't actually let me put gay characters in a book that is essentially for children?
Well, okay. as far as Mystique and Destiny goes, they've been together since the mid-19th century. You know, I mean, by together, they're not only walking together, working together, they live together.
Sure.
Draw your own conclusions. I mean, it's a happy-go-lucky treat because Mystique can be anything Destiny wants her to be.
That's true.
And Destiny being blind, at least in the present day, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
At least in terms of, huh, okay, who are you now? But again, this goes back to what I was saying before. It was almost a game between Frank Miller and I. You can do whatever you want in monthly comics. You just have to be subtle. And subtlety can be a very broad term sometimes. You know, it's not that hard. It's, you just have to figure out, do I want to hit the reader over the head with, you know, the proverbial baseball bat, or do we just do it? And if they don't notice when they're 12, well, they might come back when they're 24 or 40 and realize, huh, didn't see that one coming. You know, I mean, John's intent from the start was that North Star was gay, which, you know, it was Alpha Flight. That's not my bag.
Sure.
Not my part of the, my part of the canon. But yeah, I knew there were characters who certainly could make people, could raise questions. I mean, all you have to do is follow the relationship of Kitty and Ilyana for years. And in a way, how pissed off, well, all you have to do is read Days of Future Past. In the last scene where Rachel's holding Kitty and saying, you know, I love you. Well, is that a kid saying something about a mom figure? Oh. Okay, maybe. You know, it's for me as a writer for being trained in the era I came from, and perhaps to a large extent still inhabit, a lot of this falls under the heading of none of your damn business. No offense.
No, sure.
You walk up to someone and say, "Hi, I'm Bill. Are you gay?" You know, it's like, huh, any more than one should say, are you a person of this color or that color? Are you a communist? Yeah. It's like, if they are a good person, bingo. Couldn't you not be satisfied with that and move on? You might discover all the other elements as you go, organically, out of the interaction between people, but that's, I guess, like life. You shouldn't hit people over the head right off the bat, because then that caption, that moment becomes, that's the story. Well, maybe it can be, maybe it isn't. You know, it's like I'm working on an idea where you think Nightcrawler's true love is Amanda Sefton. Yes, a good-hearted, heroic, almost heaven-like sorceress. And then we threw in Bloody Bess, or I threw in Bloody Bess. Huh, psychotic killer. Yeah, but Kurt looks at her and goes, there's something about her. And she looks at him and goes, something about you. So what do you, I mean, it's a yin-yang. It's, everyone looks at Kitty and Peter and thinks, huh, that's the relationship. Yeah, she's 13, he's 19. Maybe it's a relationship, though he better keep his hands to himself. Yeah. Trust me, that conversation came up more than once in the book as well. You know, where Kitty's, you know, when they're fleeing the brood and she says, oh my God, we're all going to die. You want to do it? And Peter's looking down at her, and Paul Smith, he drew like the most innocent 13-year-old imaginable in the most traditional nightgown. I mean, it's like you could not get any more 19th century perfect than that. And Colossus does the hero thing. He says, I know how you feel, and perhaps I feel the same way. But this moment will never come again in your life. And if we survive tomorrow, you can't go back once you cross that Rubicon. It's not exactly what he said, but that's the essence.
No, yeah. But yeah,
he said, you're 13, kid. Grow up or whatever.
Well, a character you create.
Subjects, but that's what it should, I mean, for me, if we're going to get on a soapbox, that's it. She's a kid.
Yeah.
Which a few years later, when she's 16 and in the clutches of what's her face? Captain Britain's girlfriend.
Oh, Megan?
Courtney Ross.
Oh, yeah, I see.
Is that Courtney Ross? Yeah. Who's been possessed by evil. And they have this whole totally self-indulgent scene that Alan Davis did beautifully, where it's Kitty's birthday, and she gives Kitty a piece of cake on her finger, and Kitty just, like, eats it up. And I'm going, huh. We're really pushing the envelope this time. Because, yes, there is a hint of that. It is a seduction. And the culmination of the seduction is at the end of the story when, you know, they come back, when Courtney gives Kitty her birthday present, which is a Jaguar. A car. And gosh, I'll have to wait like 3 years to get a license to drive it, because this is England and they take this seriously. And Courtney just said, no, all you have to do is not get caught. And Kitty goes for it because this is cool.
Yeah.
And she's in an age where wanting to be cool kind of creeps up on you and undercuts, I'm a hero. And the one thing I'm pissed off at is, I guess, I never got a chance to play further with that relationship and see where it would have led. But that's the nature of serial comics and lines.
Michael, what were you going to say before?
Well, a character that is very much in the same vein as Kitty, one of my very favorite characters, Jubilee. She has changed so much since you created her.
Oh.
And I've been wanting to ask you this well before I even knew we were going to get this interview. But
yes.
What do you think about Jubilee being a vampire? I mean, I know she's not anymore, but would you ever in a million years have thought she'd be a vampire, or one day she'd lead Generation X, which is like my favorite.
That's your book, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. This is going to be too long of an answer, isn't it?
Not really. I'm just...
Okay.
Well, it's funny because I read a review of God Loves This Morning where the guy who wrote it said, what I don't understand is why Kitty looks like someone in her 40s. You know, shouldn't she be in her 20s? And the interesting thing is Brett and I went around the block with Jordan on this, starting with, okay, how old is she? And what do you mean? Well, if you look at the Marvel structure, Reed's like in his 50s, 40s, 50s. He's the older guy. Why? Because he's got all this white hair, you know, discreetly on his side, but it's all there. And you work down from there. But you also think, huh, when the X-Men started, they were all high school age. But now Scott's in it. You know, the way we're playing it is Scott's in his 20s, late 20s, 30s. Okay, how old's Colossus? Well, I mean, sorry, how old's, how old's Colossus? In his late 20s? Okay, could he's like 7 years younger? So should she be in her early 20s? Okay. Then I see an issue where Colossus has a beard and he looks not in his 30s. He looks older. And I'm thinking, this goes back to an issue years ago when the writer of Excalibur wanted to have a relationship between Kitty and Pete Wisdom. And, you know, my head's exploding right from the start, but it was pointed out that she's underage, legally underage, especially in England. You can't do that. So, boom. He bumped her up to her early, middle 20s. Except that our points were raised. This isn't DC. We don't do that. Everything's interconnected. If you bump her up 6 years, then Peter Parker is like in his 30s, pushing 30. If Peter's pushing 30, Tony Stark pushing Robert Downey's real age. If Robert Downey is that age, then Ben and, you know, I mean, even if you go back 25 years, okay, so we're talking first Iraq War instead of World War II. But it still starts to get really, really complicated in dealing with the Marvel Universe. So the decision we got was that Kitty kind of play late 30s near, you know, young late 30s. And believe me, the Brett's original sketches were older. So we cut her. Cut her down to, we hope, was her 30s. Some people read it that way, some people don't. But this is where, you know, this is why the dialogue gets fudgy when she's talking to Kate about, you know, where she's saying, you're the age I was when this all started. The age I was in the book, that I'm the story I'm telling you now. But it's like dealing with Batman. How old is he? You know, he used to be a millionaire. Now he's a multi-billionaire. How old is Superman? How old is, you know, Peter Parker when he started out, he's in high school, for God's sakes. Now, I mean, look, if you watch the Spider-Verse movie, you've got like a whole bunch of different ages, all of which work in the movie, but making them work in a monthly comic book gets complicated. So my short answer is Jubilee was there to be the pain in the ass innocent. I mean, she, Wolfsbane, Kitty, Ilyana in the beginning, they were supposed to be the gateway for readers who are in middle school.
If you that's want how older, I got hooked with Jubilee.
Well, but that's it. You know, I mean, that's
I would collect the cards. And then I got a little older. And then, you know, you introduced Jubilee and she's like around my age. So I think, mm-hmm. Oh, wow. What's that? And then that's how I started reading the comics instead of just collecting the cards.
Well, then on top of that, too, was my wife and her little sister, you know, going back to when the character was current, you know, first from the animated series, they're Chinese American. So that was another mm-hmm. level in which they identified with her. So she was younger and it was like, look, there's somebody on TV that we feel like looks like us. So I think that, you know, it's an important character. And for some reason, I don't know how aware you are of this, people really like to make fun of Jubilee. Don't like the character. And
this is news to me.
I think she's a very interesting character. I'm just talking about from the era which you were writing her. Some of this other stuff is news to me, what Michael's talking about. But I don't, and just the idea that, you know, she was basically homeless living at the mall when we meet her. I just thought, you know, it's such a rich character.
The backstory of that is her parents were mainland entrepreneurs who lived in Los Angeles, making millions. You know, we were at the start of the Chinese breakout. But then something happened. What happened? We don't know. But it involved the Chinese consulate, and that's that. Well, Jubilee was supposed to go back to China with the grandparents, you know, with the rest of the family. She said, because she was born in the United States, screw that. So she goes to the only place she knows as a safe haven, which is the mall. Remember malls? They existed before we got, you know, on before Amazon.
Well, is it hard to accept, you know, when such drastic changes change as they get older and you're not the writer anymore, and they, you know, they make her a vampire, and then they make her not a vampire, and then she's leading the team she was the kid in.
I'll take the rap for Storm being a vampire because I wrote the stories.
But to be fair, I mean, Storm was a vampire for like one issue.
But that's it. You know, Stan's dictum to us back in the day was, these aren't your characters, like it or not. They're Marvel's characters. And none of you, other than Claremont, the moron, are going to be on the book forever. So your rule, the rule is, you get the toys for as long as you play with them, but you got to put them back where you found them, the way you found them. And obviously over the course of time, that rule has become fungible. In the same way that the Marvel style used to be plots, then art, then scripts. Now they write full scripts. Everything changes. But for me, if I'm not writing the book, yeah, I used to read Frank and Denny because I love their work, because they were stories that intrigued me. I sadly don't find myself as entranced these days. It's too complicated. I, you know, in the old days, you read an issue, you read a series, you bonded with the characters in that series, you stuck around with them. And if there was an occasional team up or a crossover, okay. I mean, sorry, Stan's basic rule to young writers was, each issue is a story. You can have continued events that will evolve over the course of a year or whatever, but each issue is a story. Why? Because distribution sucks. And there's no guarantee, if you're doing a multi-part story, that the reader will be able to get the next part. Now, if it's a good story, you can go to two-parters. You know, Stan did it himself. If it's the coming of Galactus, okay, you can go to three. Well, you can go to 2.5. The end of the last issue has to set up the next issue, which it's a fundamental rule. Don't take the reader for granted. There's something either at DC or at Marvel that's 27 parts, like five different series over 6 months. I'm looking at this and thinking, holy cow, that's crazy. Why? Well, because what if you do a shitty issue right off the bat or anywhere along the line, you're stuck with the arc. You know, as Archie Goodwin used to say when he was boss, you fuck up, you got 30 days to fix it. You know, but if that's part of an ongoing 40 issue crossover, how do you fix it? How do you get in touch with the writer of the next chapter, who may be ahead of you, maybe done, you know? How do you put the machine back together again? They find a way, but for me as a reader, it's like you watch a pilot episode, and if you fall in love with it, you stick with the series. If you don't, you turn to something else. But a lot of what used to happen in a lot of cases was you'd come back. Well, for example, Fraser. Nobody much liked the first, but they kept it around. and people came back. And over the summer on reruns, they watched it. And suddenly, well, there's the next 10 years taken care of. You know, you have to give both the audience and the series a little bit of patience to find their rhythm. And if you do, you can end up with the best of the best. But if you pull the plug too quickly, well, that's a path not taken.
I want to circle back on what we're focused on, which is this extended cut of God Loves, Man Kills, because you referenced it, and I did want to take a few minutes. We only have a little bit of time left. I did want to focus on the new material, which is this framing story. You mm-hmm. talked about it, and I really liked the fact that it refers to this X-Men Black Magneto story from a few years ago, and the character of Kate.
Only a year, actually.
Okay, so it's just felt like a couple of years. I think the last 6 months. But and just talk about the decision to kind of do that, and you know, revisiting that story, and you know, there's the moment in the original story that I think was very powerful, where Magneto thinks of his own daughter, thinks of when he met Kitty Pryde, and mm-hmm. she was 13, and this other Kate also being 13. So talk about using that story to frame this one.
Well, there are a couple of interesting elements to it. Firstly, it was originally a 6-page frame, 3 in the front, 3 in the back, which limited our options. And as I evolved the story, I kept going back and saying, couldn't we have another page? Well, actually, another page would be, how about 10? You said 6, but I'll raise you to 10. Because it's a really good idea. And they, you know, Jordan agreed with me reluctantly, and we got 10. But I mean, started to say, I read this online review this morning, and the critic didn't like it because it's like, I was expecting something brilliant, but all we have is Kitty showing up and talking to this kid and setting up the story. And my feeling is, yeah, because that's what an intro does. Ideally, when you see how we get out of the situation at the end of the second issue or the back of the graphic novel, it will all fall into shape or not. But from Brent's point of view, holy cow, I get to draw the dragon. Cool. It's, you know, I wanted to find a way to, because the world that exists today is in many respects different yet scarier, different yet the same yet scarier than the world when I wrote it. I mean, to tell people 40 years ago that your government will collect families, separate parents from kids, put them all into detention centers, that defying court orders to reunite families on all sorts of excuses and not care about shielding them from a global pandemic, just the concept of a global pandemic itself was scary enough. That's the reality. To try to put that in terms within a comic book to make it relevant to the readers, not only in terms of what is happening, but how they affect character, well, Kate in this instance, is a challenge. Part of that is the reason, you know, Kitty shows up and Kate's, all I know about you is what I see on the news, which means you're scary. You're could be a terrorist. You know, I, on the other hand, I liked Eric, he was nice until he like used his power. And then I realized who and what he was, and it scared me. I'm giving a lot of subtext. But the whole point of this story is looking at people and seeing who they are, judging the person and not. Is Nightcrawler a monster just because he looks like a monster? Or is he a decent person who just happens to look weird? Is there a part of us that will say mutants are okay, but we're only going to consider them two-thirds of a real person, and we won't give them the right to vote? I mean, that's traditional, isn't it? There's precedent. There is a subset of this country that might feel otherwise. But saying it in reference to fictional realities and fictional characters might hopefully get under people's automatic reaction in a way that will hopefully make them step back and think for a little. What does this mean? What do the words of the Sermon on the Mount mean? Look at the weakest among you. Look at the hurt. Look at those who are oppressed. Do you not consider them your brothers? Well, maybe, kind of, or not. The same goes here. It's like, hi, I'm Kitty. I'm Kate Pryde. Oh, you're a mutant. Yeah, like Magneto, like Eric. I thought we could sit down and talk. Okay, but the TV says you're scary. You're a terrorist. Well, let's talk, and you tell me.
Well, there's never been a more appropriate time than now for an extended cut of this book.
Yeah, I was
hoping there'd never be an appropriate time for the book at all. But
sure.
Surprise. Sorry, didn't mean to get. But I mean, this the thing. I'm sorry, it's just, it's not about red and blue. It's not about cities and countryside. It's not about Alabama versus Massachusetts. It's about who we are as people. Do you want to look at the people? I mean, when you talk about society, if you look back through history, most people consider society their village, because these are the people you know. These are the people you can actually meet and interact with. Now you get in your car, you drive 100 miles, and you're somewhere, well, drive 10 miles, you're somewhere completely different. How do you relate to them? How do they relate to you? What's it like to move into a house and realize the people are looking at you and only seeing your color? The people are looking at you and only seeing the fact that you're two people of the same gender, that look at you and see, huh, that's an adopted kid. How do you know? Well, because, the kid's one, and they're, you have cats, they have dogs. It shouldn't, I know I sound so naive, it shouldn't be that way. It shouldn't be that, hey, I fly on a $60 million jet. Why? Because my parishioners gave me the money to buy the $60 million jet. And when we come to church, there are 10,000 of us in the pews. And it doesn't matter that we're all standing side by side, because we're protected, because we're on the right side. And it's like, why not just think in terms of, we should all look out for one another. We should all think of one another. We should all take a step back, because you're making me do it, but because if I am sick, especially if I don't know it, I could make you sick. And I don't want that, because I'm a decent person, you're a decent person, bingo. And hopefully they will look at you and say the same thing. It doesn't matter that you're a Red Sox fan and I'm a Yankee. Well, maybe it does matter.
Well, yeah, that's when you get very specific.
That's when you get very specific. But I mean, the point is, the point of this story and the point to an extent of the frame is, in the front is the setup. Hopefully the back of the book is the payoff. But don't just react. Think for a moment. Think about what you're saying, what you're doing, what they're saying and what they're doing. If someone says something that you feel is wrong, yeah, you could punch them in the face. But why not talk first and see why they think that? And maybe if you can listen to them, perhaps they will listen to you. It is an ideal, but you know, I write comics. That isn't the quintessence of fantasy and ideals. What is?
Yeah, and look, I think that the story works, but also the appeal to the X-Men is just how identifiable it is. If you look at it as a metaphor for your own ethnicity, maybe your sexual orientation or anything, you can always relate to this idea of they don't like you because you're different. And I think that this story took it to, you know, this sort of mature level with a capital M, especially for 1982. And I think including the more modern concern that was addressed in that Magneto X-Men Black story, you know, literally the children in cages that was, you know, in the headlines at that very time. And mm-hmm. You're right. I mean, it's a timeless story, which it would probably be more appealing if it was like, oh, think back to 1982 when the world was still like that. You know, we've come so far since then. Chris, I could talk to you about this for another hour and a half, but I want to let you finish your thought. And I have one question from somebody. We've gotten so many questions from people, but I do want to let you finish your thought.
Well, I'm not going to, because it would get me into a lot of trouble. So
sure. Well, we don't want that. It isn't fair. Yeah. Well, but in any case, so we'll wrap up in a moment. But Derek from Michigan wrote this, and the concept of his question might be horrifying for you to think about. But had you continued to write X-Men, what do you think the characters would be like now today, nearly 30 years later? If you had never left, I know you came back a couple of times. But if you stuck around for, you know, the last, well, I guess 29 years, do you think that they would be largely recognizable, or would they be a vast departure from the characters we all loved in, say, 1991?
Well, my first solipsistic reaction is I'd like to think the comics industry would be a whole hell of a lot more successful.
Sure.
We'd keep saying, you know. No, I mean, my basic plan was, if I'm writing and you're reading, figure use every 100 issues as a benchmark. And 101, we, you know, issue 100, we just got off the ground. So what did we do? We introduced Phoenix. Issue 200, well, we got Gambit coming in now and Jubilee. So the idea was, you have a core group of characters like Logan, like perhaps Cyclops, but even then I wanted him to retire. That's why he met Madeline and went off to live happily ever after. The point was to take him out of the book and bring him back on special occasions. But yes, time would pass, but that means superheroes have to grow up. They have to go and live a real life, because running around in skin tight costumes is not a real life. Well, because I'm, you know, who the hell pays their taxes? Who the hell gives them spending money, for God's sakes?
Sure.
Who does the dishes at the mansion, or on Genosha for that matter?
Yeah.
But don't get me started.
No, yeah.
About that.
Well, at least for the Avengers, the answer is Jarvis. Jarvis does the dishes. But for everybody else, you know.
I thought Jarvis was a self-aware computer.
Well, he is now. Oh, no, you're right. I'm thinking of the butler Jarvis, but you're right. My references are very dated.
But Tony Stark is covered by the DC paradigm, which is somebody in your team is a multi-billionaire.
Yeah.
He or she or it foot the bills.
It's true.
I mean, no, that's why one of the first things I did on Doctor Strange was he runs into a friend, you know, an old acquaintance who's an accountant, who goes through his books and realizes, you haven't paid taxes in years. How do you pay the bills? He says, oh, and he just walks over to the safe and opens it up and it's full of gold bars. And it's like, she goes, oh.
Yeah.
You're a magician. I feel like an idiot. It's, yeah, there are lots of ways to wiggle around it. But the best thing for me about Spider-Man as a young person, as a young adult, was how does Peter pay his rent? Because I was in New York and I couldn't figure it out either. How do I pay my rent? So this is a way of bonding. But every 100 issues, we nudge the group in a different direction. And you try to find a way to surprise people. Maybe Storm and Forge do go off together. You know, it's, you find the thing that catches the reader by surprise that they don't see coming. That, you know, the hint I put at the end of X-Men The End, Kitty does find true love. Yes, her first child is a girl who's a redhead. So who's her significant other? Well, how many people does she know who are redheads?
Right.
And have superpowers? Well, I don't know. You figure it out. Or not. It's always, yeah. So the point was that I also felt that the biggest mistake that Marvel made, the two biggest mistakes, were expanding the mutant population and revealing Wolverine's origin. I mean, I think that was just, ugh.
Yeah, but I think the baby step where you actually see him in the tank getting the adamantium in, I think that was interesting. But then when it's like, well, he fought in the Civil War and then he did all this. And I was like, no, I liked when we just didn't know, you know.
I have no problem with him fighting in the Civil War. I might have gone, you know, I might have thrown him. Which one? Oh, you know.
That's a great point. Yeah.
Rome. Yeah. What? Yeah. He goes way back. So does Sabretooth. You know, yeah. It's, but the thing is that I look at when I was writing Nightcrawler a few years ago, I look at the school and all I can think of is like, you've got all these students. Do they not have parents? Are they all estranged from their relationships? Do they not have siblings? Do they not have this? Do they not have that? Why do we never see any of that? Why do we never get to know them as people, as opposed to mutant iterations? You know, I mean, the point with Ziggy and the kid who looks like a giant bug is their kids. They're involved in something that's way beyond their experience. It's scary, but if you don't, so you use the fact that they're kids as a way of reaching out to the audience and giving you a sense of what it's like to get powers like this, to have a kid wake up one morning and he looks like a bug. You know, it's none of this is, you know, it's adolescence is hard enough.
Yeah.
You know, it's Kitty kind of blacking out on one floor and waking up on the ground floor and thinking, how the hell did I get here? You don't, you know, it's giving the average reader an emotional kinetic touchstone with the events so that they can say, oh, yeah, I've been to a new school where I don't know anybody and I don't know where to sit and everybody's looking at me and making snide remarks. And how do I make friends? Where do I go? Who do I trust? How do I walk home? You know, who do I sit next to on the bus? These are all elements of life that we can, that everyone can relate to, hopefully, but you find a way to take that and tweak it just a little and put it under the heading mutant. And suddenly, the one thing leads you into the unreal reality. But what happens in the unreal reality can perhaps give you a touchstone reality and better understand the world you live in and the people who live around you. I mean, maybe that's getting a tad too pretentious, but that was always my kind of goal. When you have all of your characters living in this bubble where all they know are people like them, where all they relate to are conflicts and adventures defined by their unique reality, where the interaction with the outside is limited. And from a perspective of prejudice, in that outside is bad, they are a threat, inside is good, we are all alike. That I find disturbing. That's though, and yes, I totally concede, I am an old fart. I've been reading and doing this way long, but that's not the kind of story I would like to read or I would like my kids to read. They are not the kind of people I feel any interest in knowing. And as a totally capitalist entrepreneur, if I can find a way that this reframed God's love can perhaps reach out and find one or two or three new readers who pick it up, okay, I'll give it a look, and think, how does the end go? And then, I like this. Let's see what else I can find. That to me is, as I have said time and time again, that's gold. That's matter. That matters. That's what writers do. We try to find an audience that embraces the characters as the characters embrace them, and then they pass on the word. And if I can do that, I have fulfilled my obligation as a creator. And you know, hopefully next issue I can sell a few more copies and a few more copies and a few right. more copies.
Well, the thing that we've been talking about for much of this time, of course, is this extended cut of God Loves, Man Kills. I'm very bad with the camera work here, but
there's four different covers.
Yes, there's four different covers. There's also the second issue will come out. Marvel shipping is a little bit delayed, but the second issue will come out somewhere in the next couple months. And Chris,
I thought it was August.
Oh, maybe it is August. Great. I just didn't know how soon it was because I knew that they were doing every other month, but it seems like they're getting caught up.
Oh, okay.
Now. Great.
Because the flash I got from the office was first week of July, first week of August.
Right.
If it's first week of September, not bad. People might actually
go
that they can smuggle something in to read.
Yeah. Well, I feel like that might be an excuse to try and take up more of your time. And, you know, we lost Rachel, our co-host, because she had a work emergency. Homework. She did homework. She actually read First Flight, and she's an author. So she had questions about First Flight. I've always wanted to ask you about First Flight and Sovereign Seven. So at some point I would like to talk to you again about not the X-Men, but there's always X-Men are always at the forefront, you know?
Look, people can do worse
well,
in their career.
Chris Claremont, thank you so much for being so generous with your time. We had so many questions in the chat, and I literally got to one of them, so my apologies to everyone. And everyone who would like to keep in touch with you, you're very present on Instagram at Chris Clearmountain. You let people know what's going on in comics, but also just in your day-to-day, you know, some beautiful scenery in there too. So follow Chris at Chris Clearmountain. Thank you again for being so generous with your time. We really appreciate it.
One last thing, if I can.
Yes, please.
Either if you if anyone out there who has questions who did not get a chance to ask them, just send them to me on Instagram or on Facebook. You know, I'll be happy to answer.
Very generous.
Yeah, that's great. And I'm going to compile some from the live chat too. And, you know, maybe I'll bombard you with them. But until then,
again, I don't guarantee I'll be civil, but I'll answer.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, I know the uncivil ones, so I'll keep those to myself. The extended cut of X-Men God Loves, Man Kills, I think everybody should read it. If you're a comic book fan, if you're an X-Men fan in particular, it's a great story. Rereading it for the first time in decades, I was just struck by how great it still is. So I want everyone to check it out. For me, I'm Christian Blatt. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at ChristianDMZ. And Michael, where do people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at MichaelXShirley. And you can find me on Instagram at IHateMichaelShirley.
And Rachel is at Rach Goodman author. No, Rachel Radner author, and at Rach Goodman on Twitter. We appreciate her being here. And sorry that you have one of those job things that got in your way, but we will talk to you soon. And we will see everyone back here next Thursday at our regular time, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern. But until then, as the great Stan Lee would say, Excelsior!
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.